This is the Paula Gordon Show, conversations with people at the leading edge. And certainly that is the place that I would put Dr. Daniel Levitin. Bill Russell, do you want to go forward with that?
No, actually, I would like Dr. Levitin to go forward since he knows what he's talking about, and I don't.
Well, I wanted to pick up on something you said, Paula, about emergence and consciousness, because I've been very much influenced by Daniel Dennett on this matter, and I've thought a lot about it. And I think that consciousness is an emergent property, and I'd like to unpack what I mean by that. But for one thing, I know that there are some neuroscientists looking for the seat of consciousness in the brain, and I don't think they're going to find it. And the reason is that I don't think it's located in any one place, any more than gravity is located in one place.
Any more than speech is located in one place.
Well, fair enough. I mean, if by analogy, if we were to bore a hole in the center of the Earth, you're not going to find gravity in there. Gravity defines relationships among objects. Gravity is a process. It's not a thing that's localizable. And I think consciousness is the same. And when I say it's emergent, I'm influenced by the work of Deborah Gordon, a Stanford biologist, and others. If you look at ants, you can see a nice analogy. There's no one ant that knows what the colony needs. There's no single ant that knows whether they need more food or need to find a new nest. But collectively, all the ants work it out through a combination of chemical communication and pre-programmed instructions. But if you take the analogy to the brain, there's no neuron in your brain that knows your name. There's not even a neuron in there that cares that there's a neuron that doesn't know your name.
Which is the ultimate test.
But, of course, you know your name. How does that happen? We can't find
repetition in my case.
We find that out of a complex system of a number, a large number of interconnected elements, like ants, you get something like intelligent behavior out of an ant colony or out of a beehive. They're able to do extraordinary things. They bury their dead. They respond to the need of moving the nest if conditions are bad. They can gather food when they need to. They reorient their goals without anybody being in central command and telling them to do it, without them knowing what they're doing. They just do it. Neurons are sort of the same thing. It's when you get sufficient complexity of billions of them connected in tens of millions or billions of different ways, then you get intelligence and consciousness. Consciousness is an emergent process, and I'm using emergence in that sense. It comes sort of for free when you get sufficient complexity of interconnections.
Well, and part of the, at least the definitions I've come across, that that which emerges is not implicit and certainly not explicit, and
yes,
that from which it emerges.
Or
which
predictable.
It undercuts a lot of reductionist science, and it seems that that phenomenon in some ways is one of the most exciting things that you're working in, and that it should be the thing we care about most ultimately, which is our own existence, to me is both remarkable and presents a wonderful opportunity.
I'd say also about consciousness that I think it's an illusion. And if you'll indulge me in another analogy, when you touch a hot stove and you recoil, you have the sense that the pain was in your finger, but it's not. The pain is in the sensory receptors in your brain. And we can prove that. We have awake patients on the operating table all the time for brain surgery, and we can touch the part of the brain that corresponds to the finger, and the patient who's awake will say, oh, you just touched my finger. And then we can touch their finger, and we can touch their brain, and we can ask them, which one are we touching? And they don't know. The finger representation is in the brain. I can cut your finger off, if I have to, through amputation, let's say, and still make it feel as though you've burned your finger if I, suitably stimulate
the
brain.
Which is the phantom limb problem?
Yes, exactly. Ramachandran talks about this, the UC San Diego neuropsychologist. So consciousness is a similar illusion. Evolution has given us this illusion because it is a helpful and useful illusion to have, because when you touch the hot burner, you don't want to move your head. You want to move your finger. So
doesn't
and
do
you
much
don't
good.
Want to think about it.
That's right. Similarly, consciousness is an illusion, and there are a number of demonstrations now in the laboratory that show that what we think of as our uninterrupted, accurate view of visual and auditory sensory reality is really quite faulty. It's a kind of cobbled together, stitched together, bunch of impressions that's being constantly updated and rewritten every 50 or 100 milliseconds, and you don't realize it because whatever it was that you thought was going on is constantly being replaced with some new version of it. You don't have necessarily memory of the old versions.
So
well,
you know
this also goes, you made a point that I'd simply not seen before. The neuronal mass of the cerebrum, which we tend to think of as the reptilian brain. It's, you know, we don't do that anymore. We're advanced. We're all front brain oriented. Oh. We're smart.
Yeah,
we're
right.
Rational consciousness. All
we really need is the cerebral cortex.
Well, I know better because I live with me, but that is, I think, the general conception. And when we focus on consciousness, we focus on reason and logic, particularly as being somehow or other definitive and reliable about the world we inhabit. And yet, all this mass, the neurons that we think are so important, is not up here. It's back there. What's going on, Doc?
It is true. We have the brain evolved in concentric layers, building out from a center. What we call the cortex is actually Latin for Greek or Latin?
Greek
for bark.
Don't hold
as
me to
in
that.
The bark of a tree.
Cortex as in cork.
An unspecified ancient language.
Earlier than we.
I usually know this. I apologize. apologize to you viewers, too. Anyway, cortex means bark, outer layer. And so what we call the cortex is this outer layer built on top of an inner layer. Of course, as you know, and as our listeners and viewers know, evolution has to work with what was already there. It doesn't design systems from scratch. It takes what was there and it adds on. So we have our reptilian brain. We have our parts of the brain that we have in common with all vertebrates. And on top of that, parts of the brain we have in common with all mammals. And on top, and I mean literally on top of, because it grows out, parts of the brain we have in common with all primates. Then we have this wonderful new stuff in the prefrontal cortex that only humans have, and that I call the musical brain. That gave us things like self-consciousness and an ability to represent things that aren't there. And these are uniquely human abilities, and yet they fall along a continuum with all the other animals who have pieces of it.
And another part of that, since you speak about my favorite subject, which is evolution, is that evolution has lots of stuff there that may be just sitting there waiting for millions of years, and one day you use it. And then in 50,000 years, and you say 50, think forward, he says in This Is Your Brain on Music, what will the current experience that's brand new of contraception have to be, how will it affect us in the year 50,208?
Yeah.
I can't do that number, doctor.
52,008.
52,008.
Yeah.
The way that all of this happens and how slow it is and how fast it can be is part of what is so exciting about all of this.
Yeah.
Is that there's all of this and some of it so that breaking out of the kind of reductionist mold of, oh, well, or those who are, who was it, who called it genetic...
determinism. It was Peter Nathaniels.
Who was talking about being... a bigot. I think he may have cleaned it up a little bit, but a genetic bigot, that it's all, we're wired that way. No.
This is an interesting point, and Terrence Deacon, who's an anthropologist at UC Berkeley, has talked about de-evolution.
Yep.
And he makes the point that, in fact, what evolution has done in the case of humans is, in some sense, we've de-evolved because less of our life and our instructions are programmed in the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And more of it comes from the environment. For one thing, we have the longest maturation period of any animal. You know, we have to be under our parents' care for at least 10 years. And, you know, this ties to your point about how, Bill, about how the frontal cortex and the prefrontal cortex are still connected to the reptilian brain. And what is their role? It's mostly a regulatory role. The difference between us and other species lower on the phylogenetic chain is that we have the same inputs from our cerebellum and from our limbic system, but we can control them and regulate them. Most of what the frontal and prefrontal cortex are doing is sending inhibitory signals to shut off that stuff that tells you to do something and you know you really shouldn't. That it really
Which takes me back to music.
The other piece that you don't, the emotion.
Well, that's precisely what I was going to say, is that, yeah, and... all of this old stuff is coming through our limbic system, which is one of the places where emotion is. And yes, you control it, and yes, you can't control it. And part of the joy of music is that it shuts out the inhibitors, and you can just go to a rock and roll concert, and whether you're supposed to or not, you can dance with it. You can sing in your head. You can have the joy of it. And if you did that at a Beethoven concert in an orchestra hall, you would be thrown out, I think.
Yeah.
But as you think about the context in which the music is and the very central role of emotions, which in many ways overrides all this new stuff.
Music seems to have a privileged channel to our emotional systems. And by privileged, I mean, although it certainly affects us intellectually, it seems to be able to reach deep down into these animal parts of the brain, the cerebellum, the nucleus accumbens, the amygdala. And it, we found that there are direct connections from the inner ear to these primitive brain regions, direct connections meaning that it goes there as well as to the higher cognitive human centers. And this may be the reason why patients with Alzheimer's, when they can no longer remember their own name or the name of their spouse or what year it is, can still remember all the lyrics to a song they knew when they were 14 years old. It may be why people who are in various states of psychological trauma or distress and have become walled off from their emotions, music can still sneak its way in there and reach them.
You've done many interesting studies all around that. We'll be back in a moment with not nearly enough time with Daniel Levitin. This is Your Brain on Music. Be with us when we return.